the PLRA an action counts as a strike only if it was dismissed as malicious, frivolous, or for failure to state a claim. The question here is whether three of Mr. Bontemps' prior actions qualify as strikes. If any one of them does not, then this court must reverse. And for three distinct reasons, appellees cannot show that all three prior actions qualify as strikes. First, under Moore v. Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, three or two cannot be a strike, because the magistrate judge recognized correctly that this action was entirely moot at the time it was dismissed. That would be the narrowest and most straightforward ground for reversal. Second, this court has held that even when a single claim in an action was dismissed for a reason not included in the PLRA, the action as a whole cannot count as a strike. But at least one claim each, in Kramer 1 and Kramer 2, were dismissed for failure to satisfy Rule 8's notice requirement, rather than for failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. While appellees have said that Rule 8 and Rule 12b-6 dismissals are the same, that is not the law. Under McHenry v. Wren, Nat v. Hogan, and a host of other cases, including some cited by the magistrate in his order. And finally, third, if this court is unmoved by those considerations, it should conclude that the prior actions were in fact dismissed for failure to prosecute, and that may not count as a strike. And that would, of course, require revisiting the panel.
What is the issue that you raised in your briefing, which is we have recently decided that Kramer 1 and Kramer 2 was without merit?
Yes,
Your Honor. So the first two arguments, I think, are reasons why this case is not controlled by Harris. But you filed a letter saying this case was controlled by Harris. So what do we do with your letter?
Your Honor, I think in my letter, what I wrote was that the contentions set forth in our brief were controlled by Harris. Frankly, that was an overriding on my part. As we explain in our brief, and I think we're very clear on this, and here I would actually direct the court in particular to page 38 of our opening brief, we indicated that it was especially clear that Kramer 2 couldn't count as a strike under Knapp, and we indicate there both that the case was moved. And more specifically, we indicate that the dismissal was in fact under Rule 8 rather than for failure to state a claim. And so we did present in the brief those contentions, and it was my error in overdrafting that the first sentence of that letter. But it is our position that, as the court identified in its order, that these contentions are before the court. And of course, waiver is always a discretionary matter within the court's power, and in particular, it is appropriate to allow claims like these to be heard, where they principally involve questions of law and the defendant suffers no prejudice as a result of hearing argument on them.
We understand, I think I understand your position, and you're doing a very good job of explaining the position that you took in your briefs and your letter. But on Kramer 2, as I read Kramer 2, there is a paragraph there with respect to mootness. But there is also a rather lengthy order in which the court said that seemed to indicate that it was dismissing for failure to state a claim. And it says on page 3, a complaint should only be dismissed for failure to state a claim upon which we believe it may be granted if it appears beyond doubt. And then it goes on and goes through the allegations and says it doesn't state a claim. And then it has one paragraph that says, finally, the only relief for which plaintiff asks is a transfer, and that's all. So it seems to me that's kind of it, and it says you can have a chance to amend. And so it seems to me that's kind of a quote when you're in the can you help me with that?
Yes, Your Honor, there's a lot there, so if I could just sort of maybe walk the court through it. So I think the helpful place to start here is actually with the Moore case itself. In Moore v. Maricopa County, which was where the court articulated the rule that dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction can't count as a strike, the court actually considered two prior actions where the magistrate judges in those cases had actually characterized the dismissals, too, as for failure to state a claim. And what Moore has said is, look, there's basically two ways we can read what was happening in those prior actions. Either we can think that what the court was up to there was finding that it lacked jurisdiction and then, in contravention of clear Supreme Court precedent, going ahead and talking about the merits. Or it could be that the court concluded that it lacked jurisdiction and then sort of said some other stuff, but that wasn't really what was at the heart of what was going on there. And this is a bit different than that, I acknowledge, because here the emphasis on mootness comes toward the end of the magistrate judge's
decision. It, this case was not moot when it was filed. And it became moot in the sense that he was no longer in that place. But in Moore, there was never any basis for federal jurisdiction ever pled.
Well, more specifically, there is a long line of cases from this court which hold that a case becomes moot if an inmate files a claim seeking injunctive relief and the inmate is then transferred to a different facility. And in a case,
the question I'm asking you is a case which becomes moot, how does that turn into a case that lacks, where there's no subject matter jurisdiction in the first place?
Yes, Your Honor. It's well established that a court must possess subject matter jurisdiction at all stages of litigation, which is why this court could, for example, sua sponte raise it on appeal. And if a case becomes moot during the pendency of the case, the district court immediately loses any lawful power to say anything at all about whether or not the claims in the case state a claim for relief, because at that point it has lost any authority. And so here, once my client was transferred, the case was moved that day. The fact that later the magistrate judge then considered, then actually reached this meeting order, doesn't change the fact that it was moved from the get-go. And I think what's instructive here is that, again, you know, we have to read this against the backdrop principle, which the magistrate judge in that case actually identified in citing a number of precedents, including Sample versus Warwick, which is that when an inmate is transferred, the case is moved. There, all my client had asked for was injunctive relief. Contrary to one of the 28-J letters yesterday, there was no request for nominal damages, as the judge identified and as a review of the complaint will confirm. The judge then decided, okay, the case is moot, but it also addressed, seemingly on the merits, what it apparently understood to be a number of potential claims that my client might have brought forth. And I think, again, there's two ways we can understand what's happening there. Either the court was concluding that my client had in fact sought damages despite a clear disavowal of doing so in the complaint and was addressing those claims for damages for which it continued to have jurisdiction, or it was doing what, frankly, magistrate judges often do in this circumstance, which was identifying that the case was moved, indicating that there may be a number of cases of causes of action arising from these facts that would support a claim for damages, which would not be moved, and offering Mr. Bontemps an opportunity to amend if he wished to pursue those claims for damages.
Let me ask you something. This form that Mr. Bontemps used, where did it come from?
You're on the form complaint?
Yes.
My understanding is that would have been provided by the district court's clerk office.
If you did, which surprised me, if you look at Rule 8, it's so false yourself that you can apply to Rule 8 because you never start with what the jurisdiction is. In fact, you're preempted from making any legal argument or citation to any statute. So I don't know how your client would know how to amend. And whether, if it's a 1983 claim, maybe there is nominal damage. He doesn't get a transfer. But he doesn't even say he's bringing a 1983 claim. Or anything like that, excuse me, a 1983 claim. Or he's bringing an ADA claim. Or, I mean, it's prohibitive to do that here. I don't know how. I was trying to think, what would he do if he got this? I'm trying to punish him for not amending. I guess I'm not dismissing. I was saying if he dismissed, then he wouldn't have been a strike. But there's nothing here where he's told or he's ever asked for relief under a particular theory. It's all provided for him gratis by someone who's doing an order dismissing him, but it's not. He never has asked to even show a legal basis for his claim. I'm talking about the process by which some inmate would know how to amend his complaint.
I think Your Honor's question, actually, I agree with much of what you just said, and I think it relates to two of the reasons my claim or two really can't be a strike. So the first reason it can't be a strike is that he only asked for a single thing. He could have asked for damages, even though there wasn't a box print on the complaint. He hand wrote in the claim for relief that what I want is to be
transferred. Freely, we wouldn't have to ask for all the damages if he threw this case and said, you should have done this. I'm not going to give you an injunction because you can still get dollars. I mean, I may be being technical, but I'm trying to see what would have survived if he was looking at this when he got it, because we're trying to punish him for not having dismissed it.
Yes, Your Honor, I think the starting point here is that the plaintiff, even a pro se plaintiff, is ultimately the master of their complaint. And what Mr. Bontoms was asking for was to be moved to a prison that could accommodate his medical needs. And when he transferred, that went away. And when the magistrate judge got to the point of screening his complaint, he recognized and cited cases explaining that a case becomes moot when that occurs. And then said, you know, but look, this may also have been an ADA violation. There may have been other claims here that could support damages. You know, if you want to file an amended complaint, we'll allow you a chance to do that. And that's normal practice. The fact that he allowed a chance to amend is totally normal. In fact, the 11th Circuit, in a case that I provided to the Court of Dishonor in McKinley versus Kaplan, had reversed a district court for failing to do that. And this court has done so as well in multiple unpublished opinions.
It seems kind of counterintuitive, doesn't it? So, like, say he decided not to get damages because he thinks he can't show qualified immunity. He can't overcome qualified immunity. We should award him for that, right? He's not wasting our time. I mean, the strike is like wasting the court's time, but in fact, he did the opposite.
He said, I have a medical need, they're not accommodating it. He gets moved to another facility. The case is over then and there. The district court has no lawful power to address the merits.
So the district court really shouldn't have said these extra things.
No, Your Honor, it shouldn't have. And I do think it's common that some magistrate judges will, in these pro se contexts, indicate, you know, it does seem like the complaint may involve this or that. And if you want to amend, I'll give you a chance to do that. That's entirely discretionary, and frankly, it is advisory. That doesn't change the fact that this case was moot when it was dismissed. And I think more is controlling there. Judge Whaley's question also identified a second. I'm sorry, Judge Whaley.
I really don't quite understand why we should equate mootness at the time it was dismissed with lack of subject matter jurisdiction, because the court never, because there was never any basis for jurisdiction alleged in. There was never any jurisdiction from the get-go. There's no diversity. There's no federal question. Or something like that.
Yes, Your Honor.
That mootness means that there's no jurisdiction, but.
Well, I don't mean to sound unduly formalistic here, but the Supreme Court has been quite clear, and I would refer to Silco versus Citizens for a Better Environment, that when a case has been filed and the court has jurisdiction at that time, if circumstances, and this is only a request for prospective injunctive relief, if the circumstances change such that that injunctive relief is totally unavailable, the case is moved. Then and there.
If you alleged that the court couldn't have thought of the matter to this time of state under 1983, would the court have had jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor, the court would have jurisdiction, but if it sought only injunctive relief, it would have lost jurisdiction at the time it was
transferred.
I'm saying is it had jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor, and I see I'm running out of time. And, you know, the last thing I'll say before I come back for rebuttal is when they lost jurisdiction, the district court lost the lawful power to say that it was not a claim upon which relief could be granted, and that is why under Moore it cannot be a strike. Thank you.
Good morning. Misha Igra for Dr. Smith, and I'm here with counsel for co-defendant Dr. Sotak, Wendy Motooka. We will be sharing our time.
How do you plan to divide it?
We plan to divide it 10 and 5, but if the panel is continuing to ask me questions, she's graciously agreeing to cede some of her time. May it please the court. Mr. Bontomp failed to state a claim, and then he failed to state anything at all, and left without any claim upon which relief can be granted. The court dismissed his complaint, and under Harris v. Makeham, this means he agreed strikes. The court asked the parties to address Harris, Rule 8, and Memphis. Rule 8 defines a plaintiff's obligations in pleading. Rule 12b-6 is defendant's mechanism to dismiss a complaint. If Rule 8 is not complied with, but 12b-6 is not confined to that, there are other bases upon which to bring a 12b-6. And Section 1915 is the district court's obligation to screen a complaint and if there is no claim upon which it can grant relief, then it must dismiss. I describe these as a continuum in my most recent 28J letter, but it really is more of a synergy between 8 and 12b6 and 1915.
You would like us to think that 8 and 12b6 are the same, but how can we do that in light of McHenry?
I would not like to think that they're the same, because Rule 8 only directs to a plaintiff, whereas 12b6 is a remedy for a defendant. They are not the same thing.
I don't really understand what you mean. I mean, could a case be dismissed under Rule 8?
Yes, a complaint can be dismissed under Rule 8 for many reasons, but Knapp tells us that the ones that are applicable are when a complaint says too little or says too much. And in Von Tom's case, it was just too little. That's right, Your Honor. If you look at the bottom of the form, I believe that it says for prisoners to bring a claim under Section 1983, and I believe it's also in the caption of the form. When we're looking at a motion to dismiss generally in a 12b6, we don't look at legal conclusions. We look at whether the factual allegations state a claim.
But part of what the magistrate judges faulted him for was Rule 8. So we, and McHenry tells us that we can't assume a Rule 8 dismissal means that there wasn't a claim.
Well, I disagree that they faulted him. They didn't say the obligations under Rule 8. They repeated the two sentences of allegations that he had in Kramer 1. They said there were no allegations against Kramer or Lieutenant Poole at all. The allegations against Pulley are insufficient to state a claim. And then they say under Section 1983, you need to...
There was more than one defendant, right? I mean, so some, I guess some of the defendants, the problem was really...
So there were three defendants. And the court tells us there are no allegations at all against Gordon Kramer or Lieutenant Poole. The third defendant was Pulley, and the court expressly says the allegations against Pulley are insufficient to state a claim. And under Section 1983...
Sorry, could you just get us to the same ER page? Where are you in the record?
Yes. So on ER 90 is the two allegations, the two sentences of allegations in the complaint. And in, at the bottom of the page, this plaintiff makes no allegations at all in either his original or putative amended complaint against Kramer and Poole. These defendants are dismissed, but plaintiff will be granted leave to amend. And then on ER 91, at line 14 to 15, plaintiff's allegations against defendant Pulley concerning the taking of his property do not state a cognizable claim for relief. And the court, in each of these orders, Kramer 1, 2, and Gray, says what it says at ER 92 and 12 to 13. There can be no liability under Section 1983 unless there's an affirmative link or connection between a defendant's action and the claim deprivation. Here, in all three complaints, there was no connection between what he was alleging and a specific defendant.
And that is what you're supposed to do when you got this order that says his case was moved. Has he been transferred? And he could have been putting in there, and he knew him.
Well, the only one of these that mentions mootness would be Kramer 2. And at ER 109, where they discuss mootness, they say that the only relief that plaintiff asked for was a transfer, and the docket reflected that he had been transferred from High Desert to Folsom. Well, he asked for a transfer to accommodate his needs, and there was nothing in the record to say whether that transfer accommodated his needs. So the court says, since plaintiff has been transferred, his claims for relief appear to be rendered moot, but the court will dismiss this complaint, and plaintiff will be granted leave to amend within 30 days. So,
if you don't want to amend, then they do amend.
Dismiss. He can certainly voluntarily dismiss if he doesn't want to amend, and thereby not incur a strike.
So why doesn't this count?
Wait.
So you think he should have dismissed instead of just being silent, and that would have helped save what?
Then there would have been no dismissal for failure to state a claim under Harris versus Mangum. It would have been a voluntary dismissal. Instead, he sat on his hands for a year and a half. meanwhile, but he's languished.
I thought you were going to say that he could have amended to say that he wasn't getting the proper treatment where he had been transferred to.
He could have if he wasn't receiving treatment, but there was nothing in the record to tell for damages. He could have asked for damages. He could have sought nominal damages.
But that might have been, I mean, so if he seeks damages, but he can't overcome qualified immunity, now he's wasted the court's time, and maybe he really deserves a strike, but he didn't do that. So why don't we reward him for not amending this complaint? He got what he wanted, and maybe we should consider this case to have been victorious. Someone read this and transferred him.
So if he got what he wanted, he could have dismissed, and then there would be no strike. But he didn't do that. Instead, he just wasted the court's time.
I mean, he's a pro se litigant. How does he know he needs to voluntarily dismiss?
I don't know how much of Mr.
I mean, and the other problem is a moot case should have been dismissed by the judge. It should have been dismissed without prejudice in the first place. This is like erroneous language by the magistrate judge. So, really, this was dismissed without prejudice. That's what happens in a case with no jurisdiction. So, why shouldn't we read this as a dismissal without prejudice, which is what it was supposed to be?
Well, first of all, the claims were not rendered moot. The specific relief he was requesting.
That's all he was requesting was your relief is moot. That's all the case was about.
The claim is not necessarily moot because he can still get damages.
But this case was moot. The only thing this case wanted was a transfer, and he was transferred. This case was moot. And a judge with a moot case is supposed to dismiss it without prejudice.
If the injunctive relief he's seeking is moot, the case can go forward to vindicate the violation of a constitutional right and award $1 in damages.
No, so he's seeking damages, not on an injunctive relief claim. If you get damages on an injunctive relief claim.
In Bernhardt, we can, and in Moore versus Maricopa County. When considering whether a case is moot, we ask whether we can grant any effective relief within the confines of the case itself and to vindicate the constitutional right.
He had asked only for a transfer, and he got that made it moot.
He asked for a transfer to an institution that could accommodate him, and the court says it appears that it may be rendered moot, but I'm going to give you a chance to come back and amend, and he chose not to.
It was dismissed without prejudice.
Yes,
and he had a chance to amend and he didn't.
Well, no, I mean, this is, I think you're just saying yes, but where does it say dismissed without prejudice? I think that's your point, is that the magistrate judge made a mistake and didn't do that.
Well, I don't think it matters under O'Neill versus Price, which said that dismissals both with and without prejudice are strikes.
But we also have a case that says a case for lack of jurisdiction, and dismissal for lack of jurisdiction is not a strike. And a dismissal for mootness is a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction. And a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction is supposed to be stated as a dismissal without prejudice. Now, that's not, this opinion is all muddled up because the magistrate judge didn't say that. Instead, he says, I need to amend.
Yes, and the court used magic words. The court did say that there are no references at all to M.C. Kramer. There are no references to Pulley whatsoever. And that he's been transferred to another institution, but he can bring an ADA claim if he wants to. So the whole action was not dismissed for mootness. It was for failure to state a claim. It was for failure to link a defendant to a constitutional violation.
It didn't talk about mootness.
It didn't talk about
mootness. It was trying to give him, I thought it was trying to give him a chance to.
It was. So it says that it appears his request for relief is moot, but the court had no evidence before it that this transfer fixed the problem because he was looking to be transferred to an institution that could accommodate his needs.
What troubles me, maybe it's something that's $50,000 in making this claim under 1983. You're suggesting that because an ADA claim might not be moot, that he has to do something. That he didn't make an ADA claim. You make an ADA claim. For him by including in the order, not you, but the magistrate, which is not the claim he's making. So you're saying, well, it's not moot because he still could make his ADA claim for damages by not doing this. He's just making a 1983 claim, assuming he has notice of that, in which he's not seeking any damages, just seeking an injunction. Got it? So why would you say it's not moot? Because you might want to make an ADA claim.
Well, I'll point out first that Section 1983 vindicates both constitutional rights and rights arising under laws, federal laws. So an ADA claim would also come under Section 1983. He mentions
50 years of experience. And I would have thought about how to put a 1983 claim aside. something different than the ADA claims. I don't know what this delay is there.
Well, don't we have a lot of cases in this court that say that when you have a pro se, you're supposed to tell him what he can do in order to make out a claim? So as I read this, the magistrate judge was saying, if you want to make a claim under the Disabilities Act, you haven't done it, but you could do it this way. And he didn't do that. And then he says, well, you can't seek injunctive relief in your individual capacity. You have sought injunctive relief by way of a transfer. That's the relief that you asked for. That's been done. So that's moot. And then if you want to amend in order to show how you've had your rights deprived, then you can do that. But you have to be aware of this.
Yes, this is one of those circumstances that Knapp mentions where you can fail to state a claim if you say too little. And he mentions his wheelchair. He mentions an accommodation. And the court is trying to parse out what could be here and giving him a chance to amend to say what he meant to say. Because you're right, Your Honor, he doesn't mention the ADA. But he does mention a wheelchair. He does mention an accommodation. And the court is trying to assist him. So if you
choose the court assist him by telling him he was going to get a strike unless he voluntarily dismissed.
Well, the court gave him a chance to amend. He didn't take the court up on that offer. And that was his choice.
It was because he had no relief he needs anymore.
Well, the court did warn him in ER 110. The complaint is dismissed for the reasons discussed above with leave to file an amended complaint within 30 days. Failure to file an amended complaint will result in a recommendation that the action be dismissed.
That's even better. Now it should be dismissed without prejudice because of that. It was moot.
Not because it was moot, because he failed to link any defendant to any allegation which is required under Section 1983. And I have approximately 1.5 minutes left, and I'd like to cede to Ms. Motuoka. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Wendy Motuoka for the County Defendants. May it please the Court, I don't have much to add to what Ms. Eber had to say. I do want to address your question about whether or not a complaint can be dismissed under Rule 8. It can be. It can be dismissed under Rule 8D, formerly numbered E, in McHenry. And that process is, as McHenry explains, the complaint kind of does state a claim, but it is so long and it has so many defendants and we can't tell who's being sued for what. We can't make any sense out of it. We can order that a better complaint be submitted, and if that doesn't occur, we can dismiss under Rule 41B, whereas a dismissal under 8A2, which is the requirement that you state facts that are sufficient to support a claim for relief, that is the equivalent of the 12B6 dismissal, which is the classic strike. And I believe the court here found 12B6.
So the magistrate judge at ER 107 just says Rule 8. So you're saying we should read into that what type of Rule 8, what part of Rule 8 he was reading?
Well, I mean, you almost have to comply with Rule 8 to state a claim. That's the pleading
standard. So you're saying there's a difference, and you're telling us that our case 4 only applies to Rule 8D, and the magistrate judge just said Rule 8, so how do we know which part of Rule 8?
Well, the magistrate judge said Rule 8 and then cited McKeever, and McKeever is the short and plain statement. That's the language of 8A2. And then he went on to do the analysis that is typically done under that standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If this court understands offer maybe 60 seconds each of these two areas. So first, mootness. My client filed a complaint asking to be moved to another facility. When he filed it against particular defendants. When he was moved, the case became moot regardless of whether the other facility could provide him with the accommodation he needed, because there could not be effective relief within the confines of his case, which is the standard under Moore. as to those defendants. And it does seem peculiar to say that when a case becomes moot and the court loses any jurisdiction to say anything about the merits and therefore cannot impose a strike, it subsequently can impose a strike, either if it volunteers its own theory of damages that the plaintiff didn't ask for and then punishes him for not pleading it, or if it gives him a fixed period of time to amend his complaint over which there's no jurisdiction and he declines to do so. That is not the law.
Well, it was dismissed for failure to prosecute, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it was dismissed for failure to prosecute, but failure to prosecute standing alone cannot be a basis for dismissal, as many circuits have held. On the Rule 8 point, very quickly.
It wasn't even clear that that was, would be a strike.
Yeah, Your Honor, yes,
please. Which is actually the issue that you raised in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor, no court anywhere has ever held that a failure to prosecute by itself is a strike, only if underlying it is a failure to state a claim, but here underlying it was a dismissal as moot. If I may close the court for 45 seconds on Rule 8, there is a line of authority indicating that when a pleading is formally inadequate because it doesn't on its face identify which claims attach to which defendants, it can be dismissed on that basis alone, distinct from a failure to state a claim under Rule 12b-6. And the magistrate judge here cited a Seventh Circuit case commission, which did so 3 weeks ago. The Fifth Circuit, embodied by Cook versus State Farm Mutual, actually had several paragraphs explaining this distinction. And a dismissal under Rule 8, whether too long or too short, when it's just about the formal adequacy of the pleading and not about the success in stating a claim upon which relief can be granted, is it a strike unless it necessarily discloses a failure to state a claim, which is the rule from Knapp. And respectfully, here, Kramer 1 and Kramer 2, although formally inadequate, were not such in a manner that necessarily show failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted, and they were not repeatedly and knowingly dismissed as such, which is the standard from Knapp. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Both sides for your argument, and thank you for your pro bono representation. You've done an excellent job, and we really appreciate your volunteering in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.